Taliban as the legitimate Afghan government. Press Secretary Jen Psaki has twice cited that ongoing litigation as the primary reason for maintaining the asset freeze. Following its imperial playbook, the U.S. sanctions imposed on Afghanistan are aimed at destabilizing Afghan civil society, making daily life so unbearable that the Afghan people eventually blame the Taliban for their misery, providing the United States and its proxies an opening to enact regime change.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, you are welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, we are social beings. We live in the society. We need to have interaction with each other. We need to have give and take relationship with each other. And we need to build trust and confidence in society in order to lead or to live a happy life and a better life. Without trust, we cannot achieve comfort. Without trust, without positive thinking, and without a pessimistic view, we are not going to have peace of mind, we are not going to have tranquility, and we are not going to have comfort. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam said, "Trust is a comfort to the heart and security in faith." Now, in fact, trust also releases the pressure created by the miseries and misfortunes of life. In our daily life, in our day-to-day life, we encounter a lot of difficulties and hardships in our life as a result of the incidents or the catastrophes that take place. So mishaps are there everywhere. We have difficult lives. And the difficulties of life and the pressures that we suffer will be reduced to a large extent by having trust. Trust in God and trust in our friends and the people around us. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam says in his Ghurar al-Hakam, "Trust reduces depression." Now, depression is due to a lack of trust and confidence. Because of a lack of trust, we begin to experience depression, frustration, hopelessness, disappointment, and all these are as a lack of trust. Trust also means, you know, consigning your matters to God, to Allah, the Almighty. You know, when something happens, you should trust Allah, you should consign your matters to Allah, and that's when you will feel less depression, you will feel less disappointed and less desperate. There is not a thing that makes life more beautiful in our eyes, reduces our sufferings, and paves the way for success like optimism and trust do. Therefore, we need to be careful of painful thoughts. We need to be careful of hurtful thoughts, such as pessimism. Just as you are cautious of illnesses, you also need to be cautious of your thoughts. We need to open our minds to optimistic thinking. We need to understand how easily we can rescue ourselves from intrusive thoughts. You know, these intrusive thoughts keep hurting us. They are coming again and again, and we need to ignore those thoughts. We need to replace them with positive thinking, with optimistic thinking. Pessimism destroys our well-being, our spiritual and our mental well-being. It makes our life restless, and it makes our life full of trouble and full of uneasiness, full of apprehension, full of anxiety. So we should not pay heed and pay attention to such painful thoughts. We need to replace them with positive thinking. It is essential for Muslims to behave with each other in such a way that does not leave room for ill expectations. Let's have a break. We will be back.
Changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, you know, used to advise Muslims to think positively about each other and not to act in a manner that would make others mistrust them. And he recommended the people to avoid places of suspicions, to avoid going to places where they are suspected of doing something wrong. You know, in his Nahjul Balagha, in his short maxims or in his short sayings, saying number 341, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Man dakhala madakhil as-su'i uttuhim." Now, it means that a person who enters in places where he is suspected, then he is accused of doing something wrong. For example, if a Muslim goes to a bar where, okay, people usually go to drink wine, to drink alcoholic beverages, then obviously a Muslim person who even does not drink and who goes to such places, he will be suspected of drinking. While in fact he may not be doing this, but it's better, according to Imam Ali, it's better to avoid going to such places, even if one has an essential thing to do. So, madakhil as-su is bad. It's important that one should avoid going to such places. And Imam Ali has been quoted as saying, "He who holds hope in you has given you his trust. Therefore, do not disappoint him." Now, this means that when someone trusts you, you should not betray him. You should not disappoint him. You should fulfill his hope. And brothers and sisters, there are many, many sayings and many important traditions that have been reported from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and from the infallible imams about su'udhan, about suspicion, about pessimism, as well as about optimism. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam has been reported to have said, "La yaglibanna alayka su'u dhanni fa innahu la yada'u baynaka wa bayna khalilin sulha." You know, suspicion, according to this hadith, as I would like to translate it, but my translation is a rough translation of the hadith, "La yaglibanna alayka su'u dhan." Su'u dhan should not overwhelm you, because if it overwhelms you, لا يدع بينك وبين خليل صلحا, it will not leave any room for any sulh, for any peace, or for any trust between you and your friend. Yes, if there is suspicion in your life, you will not be able to continue your friendship. There will be no room for any trust between you and your friend. That is for sure. And also there is a saying from Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam, the 8th Shia Imam. He says, "A'lam anna al-jubna wal-bukhla wal-harsa gharizatun yajma'uha su'udhan." Verily, you should know that su'udhan is the source of cowardice, greediness, and stinginess. You know, when you are suspicious of your brothers, then you will have no room for generosity. There will be no room for interaction with your brothers in faith you will not trust them. And also there is a saying from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, who says, La dina li musi'idhan. There is no religion for a person who suspects other people, for a person who is pessimistic towards other people. So, brothers and sisters, I would like to conclude that suspicion and pessimism towards other people will destroy trust and confidence. It will destroy peace of mind, and it will destroy comfort, tranquility, love, and everything. There will be no room left for any interaction, any trust. While we need trust in our life, we are social beings, we need trust one another, and we need to assume that our brothers in faith are doing good, and that they do not do with their actions, they do not mean to hurt us, to cause any harm. We need to trust others, otherwise we will not live a life of comfort and a life full of tranquility and peace of mind. That is the end of this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
The U.S. State Department recently approved a sprawling $2.5 billion arms sales to Egypt, even as the Biden administration continues to withhold a far smaller sum of military aid, $130 million, over expressed concerns about human rights abuses by the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, a disconnect that critics said makes a mockery of U.S. leaders' rhetoric. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, journalist of the Truth Out website. This article is published under the heading, Biden OKs $2.5 billion arms sales to Egypt, disregarding government oppression. Stay tuned for more. The U.S. State Department recently approved a sprawling $2.5 billion arms sales to Egypt, even as the Biden administration continues to withhold a far smaller sum of military aid, $130 million, over expressed concerns about human rights abuses by the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, a disconnect that critics said makes a mockery of U.S. leaders' rhetoric. Authorized on the 11th anniversary of the 2011 Egyptian Revolution, the weapon sales includes 12 Super Hercules C-130 transport aircraft, as well as $355 million worth of air defense radar systems. Nothing says the U.S. doesn't care about your government's oppression quite like announcing $2.5 billion in arms sales to Egypt on the anniversary of the January 25th Revolution. Ben Freeman, a research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, wrote in response to the news. Andrew Strolane, European Media Director for Human Rights Watch, said the Biden administration is encouraging and assisting Egypt's torturers by moving to funnel more arms to the authoritarian Assisi government. In September, as Common Dreams reported, Biden administration officials announced their decision to provide Egypt with $170 million in military aid, while withholding $130 million until the government meets certain human rights criteria, including ending its crackdown on political dissidents and activists. Egypt was given a January 30, 2022 deadline to comply with the administration's conditions. If human rights were truly the center of our foreign policy, we wouldn't be selling nearly $1.2 billion in weapons to one of the worst human rights abusers in the world, Representative Ilhan Omar tweeted at the time, referring to earlier U.S. arms arrangements with Egypt. During a press briefing recently, Associated Press reporter Matt Lee pushed State Department spokesperson Ned Price on the seeming incoherence of withholding $130 million on human rights grounds while greenlighting a massive sale of high-tech weaponry to the same brutal government. Lee asked, "What is the point of withholding $130 million in foreign military financing when you're just going to turn around and sell them $2.5 billion in weapons?" Price dodged the question, telling Lee that if we have anything to add on that, we will let you know. Recently, Representatives Don Beyer and Tom Malewski, co-chairs of Congress's Egypt Human Rights Caucus, issued a statement urging the Biden administration not to release the $130 million in military aid, warning that the Assisi government has continued to engage in widespread torture, suppression of dissent, and even persecution of American citizens and the families of critics living in the United States. The lawmakers added, holding firm on the conditions would be consistent with President Biden's campaign commitments of no more blank checks for the Egyptian military regime.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio. And you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi as-salam. And specifically, we are looking at the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. And especially when it came to him and trying to eradicate poverty from society. Although Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam was a great spiritual person whose attention was always directed towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there did not pass even a day when he might have been unmindful of the affairs of people, or might have ignored even the most trivial matters, because he considered a man to be the best specimen of the most excellent creation. He looked at the world and its inhabitants exactly in the same manner in which the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam looked at. The Holy Quran says in chapter 78, verse 10 to 11, "We have made the night to serve, a dress, and the day for earning a livelihood." Obviously, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made that day and night just a servant for mankind. He made this divine revelation the basis for centralizing his attention on the human society. He revived the social law and remained busy in correcting and improving them, so that the lucky and prosperous society may come into being. He utilized his sermons and recommendations on the proper occasions and informed the people of their duties and responsibilities. Ali alayhi salam was most anxious to enforce equality and justice. His main objective was that justice should be established. After he attained the rulership, or caliphate as they call it, some people came to congratulate him and found him busy in mending his shoe and fixing his shoe. So he said to them, "If I cannot establish truth and annihilate falsehood, those shoes of mine would be dearer to me than the rulership itself." Meaning what? He had absolutely no desire for rulership itself. He had no love and desire for the worldly matter. He had no desire to be a king or a ruler or to rule over people. He had no desire for power. He says, "If I cannot establish justice, me being a leader, then surely one of my shoes, one of my sandals, is worth to me much more than your leadership and your rulership." And that tells you how simple, but yet how Amir al-Mu'mineen took the matter of establishing a social justice extremely seriously. Let us take a short break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he always desired those pious people who were anxious for the hereafter to serve the public, to gain the bounties of the next world. He said, only that person who works for the welfare of the people will be prosperous in the hereafter. Simple, direct. You help, you serve people, you will be successful in the hereafter. You work in this world, serve yourself, and just trying to please yourself, then the picture becomes gloomy when it comes to the hereafter. And also then he continued saying, "And the best thing which can be done in connection with public welfare are these." So he's trying to mention a few things that if me and you work on to establish within our society, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will guarantee our prosperity and happiness in the hereafter. One, to feed the hungry. That is the top of the list to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, to make sure that there are no hungry people in his kingdom. 2. To provide water to the thirsty. To give water, to create means for people to receive water. This issue of hunger and water did not only exist at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayh, but it still exists in our time. Many countries, millions and billions around the world, people around the world, don't have access to food nor drinking water. That's a problem we're facing. 3, he says, to provide dress to those whom do not have it. Obviously clothing. Now we see year in and year out, during winters, extreme cold, blizzards, that people in some countries, they do not have anything to wear. Where me and you, we indulge in these things without even thinking about other people. And especially in some regions where the cold is severe and people don't even have blankets to sleep with. Could you imagine their life? Or could I and you imagine ourselves be in their position? So Amir al-Mu'mineen, he puts that on the third place. And then he says, to inform the people of their rights and duties. So he leaves that to the last, before the last. But first you need to feed people and give them water, clothe them. Once they have the essentials, when you come to advise them and ask them to do and perform their duties and their rights Islamically, they can apply it. When a person is hungry or thirsty or doesn't have clothes that keeps the heat or the cold, then nothing will go through his head, because he's not in a better mental or physical state to be listening to you. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen, lastly, he says, and to protect the right of others. This is the core of the justice of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, that he worked so hard to establish. He's tried to eradicate hunger, tried to provide water for people, that he used to go dig wells for people day and night. He used to go around making sure people that are clothed and they have enough sufficient clothes to wear. He would go around trying to make sure people are doing their Islamic duties. He's going around making sure that people respecting and protecting one another. These were all in the list of what to do to become a better person in this life and also to be successful in the hereafter. So those who worry about the public welfare, those who worry about the needs of others before themselves, or at least they learn to share, they take a prominent position in the sight of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. Inshallah, we will continue this topic in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line. Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka. It is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists use explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when I mean, that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism. But in reality, it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halt its support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Mali's government has called on Denmark to immediately withdraw troops deployed to the West African nation. Malian officials say the reason to ask Copenhagen for the troops' withdrawal is because officials in Bamako were not consulted and the deployment failed to follow protocol. Mali says all troops' deployments in the country need a prior accord with the government before deployments in the African nation. The decision comes amid tension between Mali and regional bodies, and the European Union that have sanctioned Mali after the transitional government failed to organize elections following two military coups.
Danish forces, without identifying themselves to Malian authorities, committed a huge breach in regard to their internal security and also diplomatic relations between the two countries.
About 90 personnel, including sergeants and special forces, and logistics support, were deployed in Mali. Their mandate was supposed to last until early 2023. They were part of Takuba Task Force, which is made up of European special forces. It's based on an initiative by France. Takuba's 900 soldiers are to help Mali's army acquire the combat skills necessary to become self-reliant.
It's a very outrageous situation. I think they are victims of European imperialist intervention. France, which is a former colonial power, intervened 9 years ago, yet the security situation inside the country is far worse than it was in 2013.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 with the purported aim of countering militants linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France is a former colonizer of Africa. It has deployed thousands of soldiers to presumably prevent separatist forces from reaching Mali's capital, Bamako. In December, Paris withdrew from northern Mali and the city of Timbuktu 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or the French Parliament.
I do believe that France, you know, has committed grave errors in regard to its intervention in Mali.
The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. The withdrawal came amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence in Mali, which has been wracked by two military coups in little over a year.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries, including Burkina Faso. At the same time, we have a new rash of military interventions and seizures of power in all of these Sahel countries.
France has been one of the world's colonizing countries that, after many years of slavery, still controls countries spread over more than 12 territories and treats their people as second-class citizens. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of its former colonies gained independence.
Brutality prevails, and that is the imperialist hegemony seeking to extend its influence and maintain its influence internationally.
Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of resources. France currently has 5,100 troops in the arid and volatile Sahel region. Under a new plan, they will be reduced to up to 3,000 troops. Analysts say it's premature to call it the end of France's military intervention in Africa, believing Paris is only readjusting its post-colonial plans.
The Yemeni army has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the two allies waging war on the country since 2015. It says vital and sensitive targets were accurately struck with drones and missiles.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also, several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area, in the area of Shabra, and other Saudi towns with a great number of Samad 1 unmanned planes and also artillery fire. They hit very sensitive areas in Jazan and Asir, also with a big number of ballistic missiles.
Sari said the Yemeni army would continue its retaliatory attacks and respond to escalation with escalation. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both confirmed the retaliatory strikes, but said they intercepted the ballistic missiles. The attack comes just a week after Yemeni forces struck several targets inside the Emirati soil using drones and ballistic missiles.
This conflict has been doomed from the start, from the Saudi and UAE perspective, from the perspective of the coalition, from the perspective of the invaders. There is no chance for them to win. That's why there are several countries that are officially part of this coalition, or allies of this coalition, who have in reality barely contributed to it because they know there is no point to it.
The strikes are part of the reprisal attacks over the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Following Yemen's latest attack on the UAE, the U.S. Embassy and its consular mission in the Emirates advised Americans there to, quote, maintain a high level of security awareness. The statement urges U.S. citizens to take appropriate steps to bolster their personal security. The American Embassy issued a similar alert last week when the UAE was targeted by Yemeni missiles and drones. The Yemeni army is now warning international firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. The Sheikhdom is now feeling the economic consequences of the attacks. On Monday, the Dubai stock index fell by 2%, while Abu Dhabi stocks closed lower.
This has been very damaging for the economy of the UAE, which is based completely on trade, on commerce, on being a transit hub for both material and non-material trading and products that go around here. That's the only real thing that the country floats on. Without this commercial backing, the country has no future, and they think they know that very well.
Last week, the impoverished nation was hit by another round of brutal strikes by the Saudi war machine that targeted a prison, claiming dozens of more innocent lives. The Yemenis have shown that the continuous onslaught on their nation won't weaken their resolve to defend their country.
Germany's stance in the escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine is under increased scrutiny. Although other NATO allies, including the US, have also agreed to export weapons directly to Ukraine, the German government has so far declined to do so. The Wall Street Journal reported on Saturday that Berlin has refused to issue permits for weapons exports from Estonia to Ukraine.
The Germans do have a history of de-escalating and of not trying in any case to be in the forefront if there is any conflict. In the case of Ukraine, the official wording is that the Germans bear a responsibility for the happenings, the adventures of the last war.
German government officials have said they oppose sending arms to Ukraine as they fear that such deliveries could push tensions higher and make negotiations more difficult. That's while Germany remains one of the world's top arms producers and exporters, with sales increasing 21% from 2016 to 2020. Kiev is furious over Germany's decision and is accusing Berlin of encouraging Russia to invade Ukraine, while the Kremlin denies the allegations. The US, Britain, and several Baltic states have agreed to send Kiev weapons, including anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, some 90 tons of US lethal aid arrived in Ukraine on Saturday. The consignment is the first shipment of a $200 million package the US approved in December. Conversely, the shipment arrived hours after Russia's foreign minister and his U.S. counterpart held what they called frank talks to try to reduce the chance of a wider conflict in Ukraine. Also, It is believed that Washington is using the Ukraine crisis as a pretext to further its policy of attempting to restrain Russia and China. Washington has threatened several German companies involved in the construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline with economic sanctions. The completed multi-billion dollar pipeline is set to double Russian gas supplies to Germany, but has been entangled in a highly politicized approval process.
That pipeline, since more than 1 month, is ready to deliver. It is ready to deliver all that is missing, or nearly all that is missing, in the European and German market. But we are stopping it. We are blocking it on behalf of Washington. Crazy story.
Therefore, this is every indication that it is NATO members who are escalating tensions around Ukraine. The U.S., its NATO allies, and Ukraine have accused Moscow of amassing troops near Ukraine's border for a possible invasion. But Moscow says it has deployed troops along its western border to ensure its security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. The UK has accused Russia of trying to install an ally in Ukraine. This provoked a strong response from Moscow, calling the allegations nothing but nonsense and disinformation. In a statement released on Saturday, the British Foreign Office claimed to have information that indicates the Russian government is looking to install a pro-Russian leader in Kiev and is considering a former Ukrainian lawmaker as a potential candidate. It also claimed that Russia is gearing up to invade and occupy Ukraine.
They are doing regime change globally, and they think this is their God-given right to do that. They want it for Iran, they want it for South American countries like Venezuela, they tried with Guaido. This is typical Western policy, and now they are accusing again, you know, another country of what they are doing themselves. That is also a very typical US and NATO story.
It seems that London is following in Washington's footsteps. It has also threatened Russia with severe economic sanctions if it goes ahead with the alleged scheme. The UK had also supplied 2,000 missiles and a team of elite troops to Ukraine this week amid rising tensions. The timing and mysterious nature of the intelligence disclosure coincides with bombshell revelations about a series of parties at Downing Street during COVID lockdowns, as well as a record inflation level. It is also fueling the widespread discontent with the Boris Johnson government. He is now facing resignation calls even from within his own party. This raises a question, and that is whether some in the British government are simply eager to deflect attention from the problems that threaten to topple Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
In the public sphere, aerial photography and satellite images are censored by the US government, thus Google, Facebook et al., creating a situation where Palestinians are alienated from their own cartography. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jim Miles Ryder. This article is published under the heading Between a Rising Tide and Apartheid, Environmental Justice in Palestine. Stay tuned for more. A recent seminar from the group Visualizing Palestine served to present four graphic representations of environmental problems within Palestine. The graphics are self-explanatory and need no review here. They are after all graphic and speak well for themselves. The discussion talked around the graphics, what they emphasize, and how they are necessary for a clear understanding of environmental issues in Palestine. The overriding message of the environmental perspective of the discussion is that it cannot be separated from the colonial settler geopolitical message. Colonial settler actions are destructive and extractive for indigenous environments, whether in Palestine or in other areas of European Western conquest. While not described as such, the presentation very well fits under the academic rubric of cultural geography. The effects of culture on geography and its corollary, how changes to geographical situations are used to create a dominant culture. One of the recurring issues was presenting maps, a graphic that can reveal much about colonial destruction, settler extraction, and attempts to greenwash settler actions. In the public sphere, aerial photography and satellite images are censored by the U.S. government, thus Google, Facebook et al., creating a situation where Palestinians are alienated from their own cartography. This has two main components. First, after the Nakba and the destruction of over 500 villages and towns, the Israelis researched all Arab place names to be replaced with Hebraized or biblical names. Most of the villages destroyed were completely demolished, completely erased through manipulations of the map. Further, more than 180 were concealed by parks and reserves using non-native species planted on the land to conceal its original occupation. The fake regime of Israel has used this in a form of greenwashing, able to boast about the many trees it has planted and the forests and parks it has created, all the while eliminating any trace of indigenous land. Most people probably do not see this as an environmental issue per se, but the environment cannot be separated from earlier the geography or the culture of a place. The land is the people. These spatial representations make the visualizing of Palestine objective and factual. The one graphic map on hazardous waste sites fully demonstrates the toxic occupation of Palestinian lands. The most compelling statement made during the discussion on cartography was the settler colonial imperative is to create private land for profit, a strong summation. Climate change and environmental damage affect women and youth severely. Childhood diseases due to malnutrition and poor water quality, particularly mentioned in Gaza, affects women as caregivers. Recent heat waves, the loss of electricity, and the density of refugee settlements have exacerbated women's access to healthcare facilities and information. Women working in agriculture are not considered in studies and research. After displacement due to flooding, women do double the work and most of the family recovery. All this, heat, floods, poor agricultural compensation, all have the most impact on women and thus the families they support. The discussion on youth and environment centered on the question of why or why not Palestinian young people would participate in the climate strike actions as seen in many other countries. It comes down to the question of, will I be alive tomorrow? What is more important, my surviving for another day or protesting climate issues? The latter would induce a reaction from the Zionist regime interest in the form of military action or settler action to protest the violence of the youth protest. As for recycling, systems and geographies created under occupation do not allow for an interest in recycling efforts. Gaza carried much of the discussion as it is an imprisonment enclave entirely controlled by the Zionist regime. It suffers from issues as indicated, from heat and flooding, but derived in part from this food insecurity. In addition, 25% of good agricultural land is in the buffer zone, declared by the Zionist regime, a de facto free fire zone for the IDF. The Zionist regime controls food imports and exports by way of the Gaza blockade. Military and foreign aid pressure is used to deliberately increase the cultural destruction of Palestine. The deliberate destruction of the emblematic olive trees is an attack on both food security and cultural identity. The 15-year blockade of Gaza has weakened and jeopardized Gaza's infrastructure, in particular with water, wastewater, and general pollution. The Zionist regime water diversion and co-option of Palestinian agriculture, that is, strawberries in northern Gaza, marketed as production, seriously affects the food security of the population, now at 68% of the population, and only going to increase as the adaptive capacity of Gaza is already exhausted. They are economically and socially and culturally much more vulnerable to damages. The field of cultural geography covers the various topics raised in the discussion of the environment and its impacts on Palestine. Ironically, from the title, apartheid was not discussed per se, but is evident through the discussions of parks, forests, erased villages, hazardous toxic waste sites, and Gaza, and is visible on the cartographic expression of the geography. The graphic information presented by visualizing Palestine is clear, immediate, and easy to understand. It is an important addition to the overall struggle for freedom from colonial settlerism, ethnic cleansing, and the apartheid nature of the system it creates.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, coordination of factors and elements of training or raising children. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of coordination of factors and elements of raising children or raising kids. As we know that the environment, especially in the vest that we have within the house, and if you are following the Islamic lifestyle, we try to train kids or raise our children in a way so that they become the best Muslims in the Western society, in the non-Islamic society. But there is a factor, and that factor is that when they go out, even if you're going for the shopping, if you're going to the park, if you're going to any place outside your house, they see a non-Islamic environment around them. They are attentive towards a non-Islamic environment. And this atmosphere basically can bring a duality in their personality. So we need to somehow control this being the parents. And it can be controlled if we can control our movements, if we can control our basically the places where we visit, and if we can control and we can limit these things. Somehow, in the Western society where people are living in non-Muslim countries, they can handle this coordination which is between the factor of inside ha-